Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. I hope you all had a very lovely and relaxing holiday, and that you are able to take it a bit easy, have a bit of a breather before this year finally comes to an end. I'll have a couple more shows airing in between now and then. Today, I'm taking a break from my coverage of the Whistler Film Festival to bring you two fantastic musicians. The first, Kathy Valentine, former bass player from the Go-Go's, who talks about her new memoir, All I Ever Wanted. And also, Canadian soprano Susie LeBlanc on becoming artistic director of Early Music Vancouver. That's coming up on Endeavors.
You're listening to Endeavors Radio with your host from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Dan McPeak.
When you think of great female rock bands, female rock singers, a few come to mind. Joan Jett, Carol Pope. Today you've got bands like Haim. But if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, you probably remember a band called the Go-Go's. Charlotte Caffey, Belinda Carlisle, Gina Schock, Jane Wiedlin, and Kathy Valentine. And what makes the Go-Go's, what makes them such a unique part of history is that they were the first all-female band that wrote their own songs, played their own instruments, and had a number one record on the Billboard 200 charts. And that was in 1981 with Beauty and the Beat. Kathy Valentine was the bass player for the Go-Go's, even though she originally wanted to be the guitarist. She's also played with the Bluebonnets and the Delphines. Growing up in Austin, music was always a part of Kathy Valentine's life. She wrote about it in her new memoir, All I Ever Wanted, which I got to speak with her about last week. This is my conversation with Kathy Valentine. Good afternoon, Kathy Valentine. How are you today?
I'm good, Dan. Thank you.
How's this year with the quarantine and everything been treating a rock star?
I've been busy. First of all, I'm super grateful. I lost all my income for the year, but at the same time, I had enough to get by, and that's not the case for so many people. So, and on the other end of gratitude, I've stayed healthy. I haven't gotten sick. None of my family or loved ones has gotten sick. So I'm coming from a lot of gratitude. And in terms of what I wanted to do with my book, that kind of sucked. But at the same time, I've been able to do a lot virtually. So, I've been busy. I've been really busy. I went back to school, which I don't know if I would have done if it wasn't a pandemic. I'm graduating in the spring, and it's crazy. So, and I've learned how to do video editing, which is a fun thing to do. I like tweak out for hours making videos. So, and I've gotten tons of time with my daughter, who's turned 18 and probably would have been with her friends like constantly if it wasn't for the pandemic. So I've gotten that year before college, I've gotten more time than I think any other parent gets with their senior. So that's kind of cool.
I've talked with a lot of musicians about how the industry has had to adapt, during this time. How do you see the industry, the music industry, sort of moving forward, coming out of this? How do you think it's going to have to change, if at all?
Well, I think there's something to, I think people are really gonna, welcome back concerts and clubs. There's nothing like being in a concert. There's nothing like being in a club and seeing a rocking great band or the coolest band before they break open or something. So I think that'll definitely come back. But I think something else is here to stay, and that's these personal, intimate, just somebody with their guitar in their living room, going on Instagram Live or on YouTube or whatever medium or platform they use. There's something really nice and intimate about that, and I think people are going to keep doing it. So I hope so. And as far as I've talked about making videos, I mean, for an artist, whether you're a filmmaker or a writer, a musician or a songwriter or a visual art, whatever your art form is, the big challenge is always, how do I get an audience? How do I get someone to see it or hear it or experience what I've created? So this has just been another way of figuring that out. I've been lucky because I was in the Go-Go's, and the Go-Go's have an audience, but I do tons of other things, and most of it doesn't get seen or doesn't get a big exposure, and I've played in lots of great bands and written lots of cool songs and produced some great records and all kinds of stuff. So it's always like, how do I get it out there? And the pandemic has been kind of an awakening for some people that might not have had that challenge. So it's all, you've got to take what you're dealt, right?
You mentioned the Go-Go's, of course. You were the first full, I think, fully female band to have a number one. And you mentioned in the book about how there wasn't really anybody doing what they're doing. And even today, we don't see a lot of, 100% female bands. We see a lot of sort of maybe female fronted bands, maybe female singer-songwriters, but not, all members are female. Have you thought about why that is? Why maybe women tend to gravitate more towards, solo stuff than, having a band, a rock band 100% female?
I have thought about it a lot. It interests me a lot. And I think there's a number of obstacles that get in the way. And I am excited for how many more, I mean, there's so many more women pick music and play instruments for a living. Most major artists have female musicians in their band, and I don't think it's tokenism when you're Beyonce and can choose whatever band you want, or Pink or Lenny Kravitz, David Bowie was always great with that. So it's awesome how many amazing female musicians there are. But yeah, I've wondered like why more women don't start bands and with other women. And I guess there's a lot of things. And I think part of it is that it's not always easy finding other women as serious that want to do it for the long haul. And some bands, it has to be a long haul. Not all bands make it. And so there's that. I think a lot of women, like they end up maybe when they get married or decide to start a family, like a lot of guys, I know a lot of guys, and I have always known a lot of guys, that they start a family and then they just go out on the road and they're just like out doing it. And it's the woman that stays home and raises the kid. And that's how I would want to be. I mean, when I had a baby, I wanted to be with my baby. I don't want to be on tour. I was successful enough that I could tour with the Go-Go's and bring, a nanny along, but it was a drag. It was like worlds colliding, and it was hard to be a mom and do all my band stuff. So I think it's hard on women in that regard if you want to, if you want to have a family and stuff. And I think also It's just, I'm not sure because women, I do think women are drawn to the idea of a sisterhood, and a female band is super, it's like really sisterhood. It's really an amazing experience. I mean, you always hear, like my daughter's applying for colleges, and we look at a lot of YouTube videos about, what it's like for, for incoming students, and this whole thing about, sororities comes up, and I'm like, just be in a band, you don't need to be in a sorority. If you want that sisterhood, you can, there's other ways to do it. But anyway, yeah, I think about it, I wonder about it. The Go-Go's obviously thought our success would kind of knock it open, and that certainly the NC, that there was no reason an all-female band couldn't be successful and write hit songs and get out on the road and promote them and all that, and have the charisma and the personality to hold an interest of an audience and all that.
You talk about being a mom and how that's influenced you, and but also a lot of your book is about the relationship with your own mom. And I think for a lot of people it might have been a shocking to read your about your childhood, but it seems very, at least to me, very much out of the time, sort of late 60s or early 70s. Have you thought a lot about, I guess, just in your creative life, how much that upbringing or sort of that, being more of a best friend with your mom rather than mother daughter, how that has influenced your art at all?
Well, I think it was more like career-wise. There was something about, and for a young girl, not being parented was definitely difficult. I don't know many 11 or 12-year-olds that are very good at taking, but that was what I felt like it was my job, was to take care of myself and figure out how the world worked on my own, and I was not really good at it. No big surprise there. But on the other hand, this way my mom lived in the world was like, oh, the rules don't apply to me. She never thought about the future or consequences or whether something was allowable or not. She really thought of that like was for squares or something. And there was something about that that I think kind of reinforced like my idea, besides just being young and kind of brash, there was something about that that made me reinforce the idea that why not? Why couldn't I make it in the business? Why can't I move to LA and make it in a band? Why couldn't I be in an all-female band that got to be? I mean, my goal was to be in a band that was like the Stones or something. That was what I wanted. The Go-Go's were the Go-Go's. We weren't the Stones, and we got to do what we did. But my dream was to be in a long-term, like career-sustaining band, like U2 or Radiohead or Green Day or the Stones or the Who or just any like Foo Fighters. I mean, every band I think of that's long-term career is males.
You just mentioned a lot of British bands there, and I know your mum was British, and you talk about the defining moment when you discovered Susie Quattro when you were 15. But how much of the so-called British invasion do you think had an influence on the type of music you wanted to do?
Well, one of the things I love about growing up in Austin was that I had a very no rules approach to music too. Like there was no reason you couldn't love David Bowie and Hank Williams in my book, or Freddie King. I mean, I loved punk rock, I loved R&B, I didn't have those genre, or like you couldn't. It was just kind of an interesting time, and Austin kind of helped reinforce that as well with this whole like melding of like rednecks and hippies. They had this whole cosmic cowboy thing with these awesome troubadours, Willie Nelson. And I just kind of had this approach that a good song or something cool was cool, whether regardless of genre. And I think for me, the Stones and the Beatles and Bowie and T-Rex were two or four of biggest bands that I love. But I'm from Texas. I also loved ZZ Top. I loved, like, I'm trying to think, a lot of it was English. I loved Humble Pie, I loved, But for American side, I liked, Hendrix and probably more English bands, for sure. More English bands. I never thought of it till you said that.
Is you know, it's funny. Is there a certain mentality or attitude that maybe the Brits can convey that breeds a certain type of musical creativity as opposed to what the Americans do?
I don't know. I think, so much of what, they were so influenced, so many of those bands by American blues artists and Buddy Holly, and so it was just this kind of cool back and forth reciprocal thing, I think. And I think their recognition of that, and then the American bands copying the British bands that were copying, it's just, I like to see a reciprocal thing. But yeah, I think I liked more English bands for sure. Although I loved once it got to be punk rock and stuff, I loved the Ramones, I loved Blondie. A lot of that scene was a huge influence for me in terms of moving into my career. It's like, okay, because I started out on a guitar and I thought I had to play like Jimmy Page or Eric Clapton or, somebody or Peter Frampton to be in a big band. That's what I thought it had to be like. And I was young, I was, 15, 16, 17, and all of a sudden there's punk rock and you're like, well, you don't have to play like that. You can just be freaking cool and have a cool. And you can start now. And so punk rock had a huge influence on me too. And very song oriented. I've always been song oriented.
You open the book with a conversation with your daughter, and she asks you, why are you writing this? Did you think about why now was the right time for you to tell your story?
Now felt like a time because there was so many things that had led to it. Number one, I was in my 50s and the Go-Go's were not working a lot. And my bands that I love doing and I love playing music, but it seemed like the idea lightning striking again and really being able, and I must survive. I mean, that's how I am wired, is to take care of business, take care of myself, make sure I'm going to survive. So when I start, I'm very oriented that way. When I see like, okay, I don't know if I'm going to be earning a living like this, and I felt like I could write. I felt like I could be a writer, and it was something that I do. And the memoirs felt like a good foundation because this is a story that only I can tell. It was a compelling story. I was sure of that, and I also felt like people need to start reading women's stories that aren't, so typical, read about why a woman might need an abortion or why a woman need to like get sober, and why a woman, I don't know, I just felt like as a woman it was important to tell my story. And also there's not that many women that have achieved this level of success that I was lucky to get in the Go-Go's. Also finding yourself, I don't think it's that different to lose my band that my entire identity is built around and lose it and have to find myself as maybe the woman who gives her whole career away to be a mom and then ends up without those things and has to find herself. And I felt like that was, I felt like my story would resonate with a lot of readers, not just women, but men that could relate to the human parts and the journey of being a human. And then you throw in the Go-Go's and the success and the right of that. And I just thought it would be a good book. And I'm really, really proud of it.
Rock punk music is, I think, very outward, and it strikes me that writing a book, there's a lot more introspection involved. And you said you're very song oriented. How different for you was the process of writing a long form book versus, a 2 or 3 minute song?
It took a lot of figuring out how to do this. a song, even if I'm only, and I'm very picky. I'm a perfectionist. I mean, I agonize over every line in my song. I put out a solo album in 2005, not because I wanted to be a big solo artist or star or anything, but because I was pregnant and I wasn't playing in a band. I thought, oh, I'll make a record. And but I just remember like how every line in every song, because that was my record. I had control. I didn't have to like work with other writers or work for a band or do it for a band. So I am just so picky about that stuff. So to try to be that, but no matter how picky you are with a song, that's what I was going to say, is you're going to get it done. You're either going to finish it or you're going to chuck it and start a new one, but it's going to get done in a few weeks. Book is a whole other story. This is hundreds of pages, and I had to learn a whole new process. Having said that, there was a lot of things from songwriting that helped me write the book. I had not only songwriting, but being a musician, I had learned to trust myself as creator. I had learned so much about it's just as important what you take out as what you leave in. I had learned about, trusting that my judgment. What note do I play? What note do I not? I pull back when I push myself forward. And these are kind of things that are very relevant to writing as well. And I started out by just overwriting. I wrote 100 more pages than ended up getting published. I overwrote because I thought it's easier to trim down and than it is to just fill up a blank page with stuff. And so I learned a lot, but I had some good from being a songwriter. It was hard though. There was many times where I wanted to stop or that I didn't think I would be able to do it. I remember I was at a party once and I met a writer and I said, I don't think I can finish this book. I'm gonna call the publisher. I'm gonna give the advance back. And he just looked appalled. He's like, oh no, you never do that. You never give the advance back. You finish that book.
I know that your bandmate as well, Belinda, has also written a memoir. Did you go to her for advice at all on sort of not only the process, but the aftermath of when the book is actually out?
No, because her book came out in 2010, and I started my book in at the end of 2015, maybe the beginning of 2016. So it had been a long time. I knew that my book would be a very different book. Her book was helpful to me a lot of times. I felt it was okay to write about something if she'd written about it. And any Go-Go's interviews were like I tried very hard to full of people's privacy and make sure I was telling my story. But if it was common knowledge, for instance, that Charlotte had done heroin or that Belinda had a coke problem, I felt kind of okay that I could reference those things. So I was really careful. So that was helpful. But yeah, I think we had a very different experience writing them and wrote very different book. And the other thing that's interesting was I wasn't in the Go-Go's when I started my book. I had, and I allude to this in my epilogue. A lot of people were like, why didn't you write about when you had the falling out with the band and you got basically kicked out? And I'm because this book ends in 1990. It's a arc from night. It's the 70s and the 80s. It starts in 1970. It ends in 1990. So I didn't need to write about being out of the band. That's another book. I'll do that. I will definitely write that story. But it was fascinating because I was out of the band for 5 years, and that's when I started my book. And you would think that that would make me be like, I don't like that. We had a big falling out. I had to sue them even because to protect my financial interest of everything I'd built up for 30 years. What I found was that it was very healing, and I found that I didn't want to be vengeful and vindictive. That wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to celebrate what happened in the band, and it really helped me heal so that when I got back in the band, I didn't have a big giant chip on my shoulder or a grudge. I was just grateful that we were able to overcome the dysfunction and the toxicity of what had happened when we fell out. And writing the book helped me heal on so many levels and process things in a way where I could kind of just see my part in things and let go and forgive myself and forgive the people that had done wrong as well.
And I know everything is good between you and the rest of the band now, and I know there was a documentary released earlier, and I know you released a song. I think it was back in July. Was it your first new song in 19 years? After the world comes out of this time that we're living in, could we see another Go-Go's tour at all?
Yeah, we have a tour scheduled. We were going to go on tour last summer. My last shows with the band were in 2018, and I did like 7 or 8 shows, and it was wonderful for me having missed out on some other tours. Well, but I was busy. I was writing my book and all this stuff. But they asked, I was obviously back in the band out as of 2017, and then 2020, we did. We got to experience the release of the documentary, and we had a whole tour planned in the summer of 2020 that the pandemic waylaid, and now it's scheduled again for this summer. I have no idea whether the world will allow for that or whether it's going to be possible, but I've got it all marked down on my calendar, and I'm certainly hoping for that. But I'm really hoping we get the chance to perform again. I think it's a really special band, and it's always a blast getting to play in the Go-Go's. I never took it for granted, never didn't appreciate that.
I think there's a certain stereotype a lot of people have about what it's like to be a rock star or in a rock band. Obviously, the 70s, 80s, it was very, very drug fueled. For you, as having been in this band 40 years now, is there a different mentality of being a rock star when you're 20 versus when you're 60?
Yeah, it's very different. There's things that are the same for me, and I think I wrote about this really well. One thing that music has always done for me is stop me from thinking, and it doesn't have to be in a big in front of a big audience. It can be in a rehearsal room. It can be just me with a guitar. But once I start that act of writing and creating or playing music, the brain stops monkey chatter, and it's just I'm very much in the moment. I'm always surprised sometimes that I'll finish playing a set with my band and go, "Oh yeah, I'm a mom. How's my daughter doing?" Like I literally don't think about anything. So that's the same. What's really different is, and it's frustrating for Go-Go's fans because we are not a very high-functioning band. We don't really do much, and it's hard. They don't understand it. Like, why don't you guys write more songs and make records? And it's really hard to explain that when you're young and you're like in your 20s and you probably don't have a household and a family and responsibilities, and your energy and your focus and your motivation and your passion all is aligned. You're in a band where everybody wants the same thing at the same time in the same direction. And that's a force. That is quite a force. I don't think any band that doesn't have that force can make it. That's a one thing if you're Prince and you're the visionary artist and you can put whoever you want around you. But if you're a band in the same sense that, Green Day or REM or U2 or is a band, you kind of all have to be in the same place. And for the Go-Go's, that happened for a while. And once we broke up, it only came back in little sections. It's never been, and I don't think any of us would be happy having that be, wouldn't be enough for me, that's for sure. And even though it certainly is lucrative and it's nice to go out and make enough money to pay your bills doing something so fun as being a go-go, on so many levels, it wouldn't be fulfilling for me, and I don't think for anybody else. So, and a lot of it, to be completely upfront, is, Belinda has, she has a huge career outside of the go-go's and had more hit songs than the go-go's have had. She can go tour anywhere in the world, where they would be like, "Who's the Go-Go's if we went there?" So she's not going to give that up. I'm not going to give up the things I love doing.
You know,
Everybody else, same.
You know, it's interesting when I feel that whenever you're in a band, there are certain, I guess, members that maybe get more attention. You know, usually the lead singer or the guitarist or the drummer. And if you look at the history of bands, bass players are kind of always maybe don't get the spotlight as much. Sting and Paul McCartney being the exception.
Yes.
How does that affect, do you think, the overall, I guess, makeup of and turmoil within the band? Is it something that you accept really early on? You know, Belinda being the singer, she's obviously going to get, you know, more attention than the rest of you.
Well, I can only speak for myself, but my template for what a band was in my whole life was that, was like the Stones. So I spent most of my career looking for my Mick Jagger. I the template of lead singer and the band behind them was kind of what I just accepted. And that was fine with me. I didn't want the front person. I would have rather been the guitar player. That's what my dream was to, I wanted to be the Keith, find the Mick, I'll be the Keith. Find the Roger Daltrey, I'll be the Pete. That was what my dream was. But at the same time, a bigger dream was just making it and then getting to play music for a living. That overshadowed everything. So when I met the Go-Go's, when they first asked me to substitute on bass, I just thought it would be a lark. Like, yeah, I can play bass. Why not? It was only when I learned the songs and felt what it was like to be with them that I realized this band has the song. It has this feeling of chemistry. I don't care if they want, somebody to play. If they asked me to be the tambourine player, that's what I would have done because that was a bigger dream, was to be in a band that could make it. That's not to say there weren't times in our career that I frustrated, and I write about that in the book too. I love playing bass in the Go-Go's, and I'm really proud of the bass playing I did on my soundtrack for the book. But most of the time, I play guitar, and I think that's what I tend to do better. But there was times I was frustrated, but I kind of just got to a place where I thought of myself as a musician. And that's kind of where I end up. It's like I'm a musician, I'm very musical, and I'll play the instrument that is needed to play. I love making videos at home where I play everything. That's one of my favorite things to do now. So I was always totally fine. I never wanted to be the front person or the spotlight. But then the weird thing is, you write a book and you are the front person. All of a sudden, I'm like, okay, I didn't really do it for this reason, but here I am, and it's like war, so because there's not that cushion of a band around you.
We mentioned the documentary that premiered at Sundance earlier this year, and biopics of musicians are all the rage right now. Queen, David Bowie, Elton John, I think Helen Reddy and Aretha. Do you think the Go-Go's story could be dramatized on film one day? Has that been a discussion? Has there been any talk of that?
Yeah, there's been talk, and we've been approached many times over the years, and it's never seemed like a very good project. So it still comes up here and there, but the documentary, the real story is so, and people love the documentary. But I'm hoping actually that my book, without the Go-Go's part, gets made into some kind of series or film because I think it's got. And I think it could really translate well, just in terms of a period piece with the relationship and all that stuff, and having music as a sub thing. So I have my own hopes, not to be the Kathy Valentine story, but to have a fictionalized version of my book, I think would be great. That's my
Have
big
you thought about who would play you? Somebody famous and unknown? What do you think?
No, I don't care. I just want somebody that can write it really well. I love like Phoebe Bridgers. I would to find somebody that could just get all that grit and edginess and still make the story something that's so watchable and entertaining.
Given that the Go-Go's were the first female rock band to have a number one hit, who are some female rock bands that you really like today?
Jizz, they're from Canada. I like them. I like X-Hex. Not sure where they're from, but I like them a lot. I think there's a band. Oh God, I'm so blanking. It's a two-piece band in England. Really cool. I'm blanking. What's
Bones.
their name? Yes,
Bone?
Bones UK. Bones UK. I like them. They're awesome. There was a duo from LA for a while called Deep Valley that I loved. Let's see. And I still like, I love a lot of the bands that came, bells that came out of the wake of the Go-Go's, like Veruca Salt and Tanya Donnelly and Kathleen Hanna, Bikini. I love the music that a lot of those girls that came after the Go-Go's, women made. I shouldn't girl them. I like a lot of that stuff too. And the Breeders, you know. And what else? What other women? I made an entire playlist of all female bands, and I can't remember now. I'm blanking. But I gave you a bunch.
For people who read this book, and they should, because I think it's very well written. What do you it, is there something that you want people to take away from it at all?
Well, selfishly, I want them to take away that I'm a really good writer and that they should be interested in any other book that I write. But also, I think aside from the selfish wanting of that, would be just to kind of learn that, you know, you can still have success, you can still have love, you can have a family, all the things that seem like they're for the normal people, that the misfits can get that stuff too, the people that screw up or have screwed up lives or not the most ideal situation. I think it's always people like these stories of redemption. Also, I like the way I talk about sobriety and getting sober, because a lot of people have told me that me writing about that has helped them realize that they had a problem. And sometimes it's almost harder for the people that aren't like the complete falling down messes, you know, that have lost everything or gone to jail or been arrested it's pretty clear you have a problem when that's the result. But a lot of us, we still function. We're just inside, we're unhappy and we're not facing or dealing with things, and we use drugs or alcohol as a crutch, and yet we're still functional and can keep our job and not screw up our whole lives, and yet it's stopping us from being our best self. So I think that's a really important part of the story too, and a lot of people have said that helped them, and that makes me really happy.
Well, I know we're just about out of time here. Any advice you would give for perhaps young, aspiring musicians, rock stars trying to make it in the world today?
It's such a very different business. I think being as good as at many as many things as you can be good at is really good. I always tell people they should write songs, learn how to compose, write songs. If you can't write lyrics, you know, write music and find someone that writes good lyrics, you know, but find a partner that fills in the stuff you can't do. But I think being able to create your own music is key. And that way, also, if you're a composer, you've got more options. You can provide music to soundtracks and to TV and film. So there's that. And I think also being a hustler. I just don't know if I could a hustler that you have to be. But you know, there's entire careers being built off of SoundCloud and YouTube, and I don't know if I could do it, but I think knowing how to hustle that social media to get your audience is key. You know, it's not the ideal. I don't think any of us wants to be a hustler, you know, but if you don't do it, I don't know how you get people to pay attention.
Well, the memoir is All I Ever Wanted by Kathy Valentine. It's a delightful read. I'm interested in musicians' creative process and their life growing up. Kathy Valentine, thanks so much for jumping on this call this afternoon.
Thanks. It was really nice talking to you. You're a really good interviewer, and I appreciate that. Thank
Oh, well,
you.
thank you so much. Stay safe out there. Happy holidays, and we look forward to the sequel whenever it may come out.
It will. Bye.
Bye, thank you. And that was my conversation with Go-Go's bassist, Kathy Valentine. Her new memoir, All I Ever Wanted, is out now.
If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or your computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
From rock music, we shift to classical and opera. And if you're in Canada, there are a few opera singers you look up to. Mischa Brugger-Gozman, the retired Ben Heppner, and of course, today's guest, Susie LeBlanc. But by Susie's own admission, she hasn't actually sung that much opera, even though that is what she is known for. She considers herself an early music specialist and is also a professor and has been at McGill University. She recently took a position at Early Music Vancouver, where she becomes the first woman ever to be artistic director of the organization. She's also lately put a lot of her time into working with traditional Indigenous musicians and giving them a voice as well in the early music canon, if you will. She has been awarded honorary degrees from Mount Allison University, Mount St. Vincent, the University of King's College, and the Université de Moncton, and received an Order of Canada in 2014 for contributing to the development of early period music and Acadian culture as a singer and teacher. This is my conversation with Susie LeBlanc. Susie LeBlanc, hello, happy holidays. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, and you?
I'm good. I'm good. I hear your the new job is necessitating a big move across the country. Moving during the holidays in quarantine, I can't imagine what you're going through.
Yeah, well, when I said I'm fine, it's I'm as well as one can be after a huge move. I'm not in Vancouver yet, but my furniture is on the way, and yeah, it's a different Christmas.
I know you're taking a job with Early Music Vancouver. You're going to be one of the first I guess female directors of that organization. And I know you've had a long history with them. What does this position mean to you?
It's a beautiful question. Thank you. It did feel a little bit fated almost, if I'm dare to say that. I mean, in terms of my interest in the job, when it came up, just because I have had such a long relationship with people of Early Music Vancouver, it's a little bit like a wonderful opportunity to continue to
to work in the passion in, you know, the music that I'm most passionate about, but with an extraordinary team of people out there and a very well-oiled organization that's been running for 50 years and that Matthew White expanded wonderfully in the last 8 years. So it means a lot. It means a chance to do many more concerts than I could possibly organize if I was just a singer. It means a chance to change a little bit things, because this pandemic has really, really made all of us artists think about how we want to share our work, how we want to share the art, and how much we all need the arts at this time is become very apparent, at least in the circles I hang around with. And so I think there's a big need to shift how we bring art to life, and that it's really a social thing, and that it's for everyone and very inclusive, and also to bring it. I like both ideas of bringing it to places where perhaps it doesn't always exist or coexist, but also to bring it to people who might not have an affinity with early music just because they don't know it. And also just because the music itself is not classical music per se. It doesn't necessarily belong into a concert hall. It belongs in all sorts of different locations because that's how it evolved originally.
You know, that's an interesting point. You talk about the social aspect, and of course, you know, we're losing concerts, rock music, this idea of going out, and yet early music and classical music strikes me as something you can, I think it's more adaptable to listen to at your home, kind of with a group of friends. But at the same time, I think a lot of young people might be turned off by it because there is this association of maybe like a bit of a higher class, maybe a little bit of the upper echelon. It's not fully in the mainstream. As an arts administrator, how do you sort of balance those worlds?
Well, I think it's very sad that classical music has ended up in that position, because it certainly is meant for all ages. And that's when it first was composed, when it evolved, it was not for an elite audience, and it was not for a certain age group either. So it'd be interesting to see. What I'm excited about is how to bring it back so that children can listen to it and go, this is fantastic, this is cool, I love this, and dance to it and really take to it at an early age. And obviously that can be done by helping people participate in it, but also by the way it's presented. And I think, that's why it's important to not have it only be done in concert halls, but try to look for ways where it can actually be performed in many other different places and occasions. So not all music fits that, of course. Some of the classical or some of the early music, which is what I know, fits concert halls or churches the best. But there's tons of music. You know, they had folk music back then, they had church music, they had court music, they had concert music, they had it all. And so I think it's just a question of putting the right program in the right place and trying to reach people that might not know that it isn't esoteric or stuffy or any of those adjectives.
You mentioned folk music, and I know your background is Acadian from out mm-hmm. east, and I think Acadian might just have the best overall music culture in Canada. You look at all like the fiddle music, traditional kind of Irish Scottish music. How do you think Acadian culture plays into the concept of early music? How do those two things go together?
Well, they go together because a lot of the music that we still sing, a lot of the songs that have come out of Acadia originated in the 11th, 12th, 13th, up to the 17th century, and were brought over, you know, without scores, but just by rote of, you know, orally. And so that music is early music. And so it has spanned several centuries, and there's still music being composed, of course, in Acadia that's modern, that's today's music. So you just have a wide range of you know, people composing music, composing songs that talk about life, that talk about grief, that talk about war, that talk about all those things that we live, that we just need to express in poetry and music. So I love the fact that because a lot of the songs originate from those centuries, that I can do them with my early music colleagues. And even though they're sometimes done with modern instruments, I love doing them the old way because that's what I know. And the melodies absolutely suit it. So it works very well with those instruments. And it's fun to mix, you know, fiddle tunes from Scotland with Acadian songs. And it's just a great marriage, really.
This idea of tradition, you know, the symphony opera is very rooted in tradition, you know, having the first flight of the Linus stand up, concertmaster, all that. Modern music, not in the same way, I don't think. What, as an administrator, is there certain things that we need to keep, like, are there certain traditions that we need to keep when we both make and consume art?
I think certain ones are worth keeping. And that's mainly mostly in the what the music was meant for. I think it's just interesting to know the context that it was composed in. And even though you take it out of its context, you have to know it to respect it and to put it in a context that you know what you're doing to it in a way. We can't know how people listen to music. Were they quiet? Were they talking? Were they, you know, during operas that were very, very long, they had lots of breaks, they had food. It was just a very different experience. It wasn't out of the norm to go to an opera performance that would last 5 hours, you know. Today, nobody would do that except on very rare occasions. So we've had to adapt things. Some of the traditions are not worth keeping at all, but they're usually traditions that came in later. 19th century traditions do not have anything to do with 17th century performance practice. And so I think it's important to work with musicologists and go back to how the music was presented, to whom it was presented. I mean, you know, people would go back then in 17th century Italy to a church to hear nuns singing when they couldn't even see the performers. They were in a side church and they just heard the sound coming. So, I mean, we're just very different today. So we have to take that into consideration. But at the same time, I think it's really great to discover things about how, what music meant to people in other phases of history and how it was enjoyed. And I think we have a lot to learn from that.
I know one thing you've been doing recently is working with a lot of Indigenous artists and working to include that narrative within Early Music Vancouver. And especially within the last couple of years, we've seen a big, I think, reckoning in terms of how we are treating Indigenous culture, whether it's within society or within art. How conscious was this for you? Why was it important for you to include that narrative in the overall structure of early music?
Well, I mean, it's extremely important if you just happen to be born in this country that we now call Canada, which wasn't that, Turtle Island. So it's just unbelievably important because we walk the land every day. Nothing to do with music. I think we need to know that names of streets, we need to know certain names of places, we need to get interested in what is our past. And I think in terms of what it means musically, well, it's just such a rich, rich culture, which is part of ours, that I would feel terrible if I said I'm interested in research and wasn't interested in researching this. It wouldn't make any sense. And so I'm very curious because I'm just learning. I'm just beginning to get into it. And I know that there will be so many more things to discover in BC and the Indigenous communities there that I have not met, and their music and their stories and the whole culture. And I know that there's many different areas in BC and not just one. So I just have so much to learn. And I'm very grateful that particularly one of my students recently is Indigenous and is very knowledgeable. And he's also an early music singer that has a wonderful career. His name is Jonathan Adams, and he sings in Europe and in Canada as a bass. And so he's been teaching me a lot, and I will definitely find other people like him to talk to, because we were brainwashed at school. We don't know. So we need to find out.
You know, on that note, how can music and, I guess, art in the larger context bring people together, whether it's from different races, ethnicities, even political backgrounds?
Well, it's a universal language. It's rhythm, it's harmony, it's song. You don't need to understand the words, actually. For a lot of music, it's not even necessary to appreciate it. And I think that it's just natural to human beings to have rhythm and song in their lives. And that is a way that we can speak to each other without the politics, without those things. So, I mean, what do people do around a campfire? You know, somebody gets out a guitar and they start singing. I mean, it's just it's so natural. And I think that music is bringing people together. It's exactly what it is. I mean, you can play solo music, but after a while you get a little tired of that.
You know, there's been a big discussion this year because of the quarantine about the value of art, the value of culture, you know, because we can't go to the theater, we can't go to the concert hall, we can't go to, you know, the cinema. How do you think our appreciation of art is going to change once we come out of this?
Well, it's really hard to tell. I wish I had a crystal ball, but I don't. however, I think that there's a lot that we've, you know, among the things that we've had to do, like suddenly put everything online and record things from our living rooms with you know, half-baked mics and telephones. Of course, that was like a desperate situation that artists just felt like myself, I just had to do something. I couldn't just stay silent. So I just took my iPhone and did something, you know, from my house. I think that was the first reaction. Then we've gotten really, really good at doing wonderful productions, which with, you know, using all the wonderful people that do video and audio, and creating really interesting projects, not just filming a concert, but finding a way to present music with all sorts of stories and video things and images that can actually enhance it. So I don't think we'll lose that. And I'm hoping that people will have suffered so much from not being able to go to live events that they will be dying to do so when it's safe. Just because we all need each other. We need to experience wonderful events together because it's just more exciting and more fun than in front of your screen. So I'm hoping that, you know, with time, with people feeling that it's safer with the vaccine or whatever else comes to us in terms of healthcare, that people go. But I think it's fantastic that other people who might not be able to go out that night because they can't find a babysitter or because they are not as mobile or whatever reason, that we've learned now how to send music to all corners of the earth with these technologies. And it's a way to connect to each other globally. It's a way for instance, Early Music Vancouver concert to be seen in New Zealand and, you know, vice versa. So I think it won't go away, but I do hope it's not what people call the new normal. You know, I really relish. I want to go to festivals. I want to go to concerts, and I hope other people do too.
You know, we're talking of tradition, and I know your background is in opera. There's, you know, probably a couple of opera singers in Canada that people can name: Misha, Birger Grossman, Ben Heppner, yourself. What do you make of Canada's operatic tradition?
Well, I mean, I would rather talk about Canadian singers, because I think that's what our strength is. I mean, there's incredible Canadian singers having amazing careers in Europe and all over the world. If you think of Barbara Hannigan, if you think of John Relier, if you think of Michael Schade, and I'm going to stop because I'm just not going to think of all the names I want to name, but there's so many extraordinary Canadian singers that have, you know, made it on world stages and that are doing it now. So the opera in Canada, I'm not even sure that I'm the right person to ask, because I'm sort of known as an opera singer, but I've done very little opera myself. I've really was niched in early music and in concert music and recitals much more than in opera. I mean, I think it's extraordinary now that we have Canadian composers writing operas. Our stage directors are being used at the Met. We have a Canadian conductor at the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, Canadians have definitely taken the world of singing and the world of opera by storm in all those ways. And I think that's not going to stop. And I don't know what the strength is, but we do produce wonderful singers.
We mentioned off the top, you know, Early Music Vancouver has been around since 1970, and I know you're the first woman to take the helm since then. What does that mean to you, being the first of something?
You know, I hadn't quite seen it that way. I see myself as third director because there were two people before me. I mean, I really see it as a continuation of wonderful work done by my colleagues, Jose and Matthew, and the chance to bring what I bring. And I mean, I happen to be a woman, and maybe it affects, you know, some of the things that I will do. I'm sure it will. But I don't quite see it as that. I don't see it. I see it as it's my first time being director of this organization and my first time doing anything like that in my life. And that, before the fact that I'm a woman, is huge, and very exciting, and I just, you know, I hope to be up to the task, and I hope to be able to do the wonderful things I plan, and I'm not sure that being a woman does that much difference in this job, but at the same time, it's true that I have a deep interest in music composed by women. Performed by women in the 17th century that has not had a chance to really be upfront in the composers that we present normally. So I'm definitely going to want to change that. But I'm not the only one, you know, and there's a lot of male directors now doing that as well. I think it's time. That's all. It's just time.
I know, you know, you've been honored many times throughout your career, but I know in 2014 you got to receive the Order of Canada, which is a big honor for many. And I've talked with a few who have received it, but what, you know, talk about that day. Like what's it actually like when you go in and receive it, and what's the feeling that you get?
Well, the first thing is that they really do a very special ceremony, and you do feel like it's a very special day in your life. So I commend them on that. It's beautiful ceremony. You just see people from all sorts of walks of life being honored for what they do. And then you learn about jobs you've never heard of before, and people doing amazing things. And really what you feel like is, oh my God, how can I possibly compare to that? Because there's so many fantastic people doing incredible things. I think the main thing that I came out from the ceremony, the main thing that went through my head was, somebody thought that I deserved the Order of Canada. Now I really have to do something with my life. it's almost it's almost saying like, okay, thanks for the recognition. I feel like now I really, it's pushing me forward to do even more. And I'm not the only one who's had that reaction. I talked to a few other people, and it's almost like people give you an encouragement, like, we're rooting for you. And then you just feel like doing much more. So, and incidentally, the person who's responsible for the fact that I did receive the Order of Canada is Vancouverite Stephen Drance, who did so much for Early Music Vancouver. So that's also a beautiful connection.
And we're going to end it off. I know you're moving from the East Coast out here to the West Coast. What are you looking forward to most about being full-time in Vancouver?
New places are exciting. New people are exciting, you know, meeting a whole different culture, actually. But I think one thing is also the draw of nature. I really love nature, and Vancouver's so different from the East. The West Coast is so different from the East, and I know it a little bit, and I'm looking forward to embracing it and feeling it under my feet and breathing the air and just learning from it, from its strength, from its grandeur. So it's both social and nature, that social things and nature that attract me, and of course all the musicians that are there that I know and those I don't know yet.
And the winters will be a little bit warmer.
I'm looking forward to that. I actually love humidity.
It'll be wet. It'll be a lot of rain, but not quite as much snow as you're used to.
Not as cold, and humidity is very good for the vocal cords for singers. So
yes,
good thing.
Well, you take your post on January 4th, which is only in a couple weeks. It's hard to believe this year has gone. topsy-turvy all over. Susie LeBlanc, thank you so much for jumping on the call today. Best of luck with the move, and stay safe out there during the holidays.
Thank you so much.
Alrighty. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Take care.
And that was my conversation with Canadian soprano and early music specialist and professor Susie LeBlanc. She will be taking her post as the Artistic Director of Early Music Vancouver on January the 4th. That does it for me today. My show on Tuesday is our last coverage from the Whistler Film Festival, and it features Sophie Harvey and Casey Novak from the film Introvert's Guide to High School and renowned Quebecois actor Remy Gerard. That's coming up on Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.